And welcome back to Gillespie. I'm your host, Josh Gillespie. We are here on FTRradio.com. We're going to have a great show. I'm really excited about today's show. Our guests include Dana Perino. I'm sure you remember her as the former press secretary to President George W. Bush and as a contributor to Fox News. And we also have Mark Tapson of BigGovernment.com, who will be following up on our conversation from last week with John Ziegler on the path to 9/11. And we'll be continuing on with that conversation. But with me, as always, is my crew, Christy Kelly of ChristyKelly.com and HoosierAccess.com, the man who makes the show run, who is working on all the bells and whistles over there right now. Mike Jazierski is also with us. Mark Warner, basically, until Election Day, is an off or on. I know right now he is on a bus somewhere with Mike Pence. So he's got it pretty good right now, I'd say.
The wheels on a bus go round and round.
Hey, Mike Pence is going around supporting congressional candidates here in Indiana as well as state house candidates.
All over the nation.
All over Indiana today. But anyway, but I want to talk about something here real quick. There's a part of me that is beginning to wonder, and I know you guys might be a little surprised to hear this, but is beginning to wonder if perhaps President Barack Obama is shrewder than we've given him credit for. Sure, his leadership abilities are, shall we say, lacking. He definitely lacks the ability to craft legislation which can actually pass. Curious for a man whose only political experience is actually being a legislator himself. But here's what I'm starting to wonder. Is it possible, that he's pulled one over on all of us? Allow me to explain. President Obama's gross incompetence has spawned legions of actual Republicans and pseudo-Republicans coming out of the woodwork vying for the chance to topple King Barack and take over the throne themselves. I can't help but wonder if Barack Obama is pursuing a divide-and-conquer strategy in order to weaken the GOP heading into 2012. Think about it. We have declared and assumed candidates lining up, each casting the same glance at the Oval Office that Michael Moore gives to a Chinese buffet. And really, who can blame them? A president with an approval rating in the low 40s is about as popular as Jane Fonda at a VFW convention. Unlike many out there, I'm not afraid of differing viewpoints and different ideas. There's absolutely nothing wrong with having mature conversations about important topics, and just like in a debating class where students are often forced to argue the opposing viewpoint, it's often very healthy to throw ideas out there which might be contrary to doctrine, but nonetheless important in getting a discussion going. One leader who also subscribes to that same theory is Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who seems to be eagerly auditioning for the role of candidate least liked by the Tea Party. We've discussed the Tea Party movement upon past episodes, and I think it's important to state that, in general, it's a movement that needed to happen, and one that has given my party the breath of fresh air that is desperately needed, a point reinforced by the nomination of John McCain in 2008. Mitch Daniels was sworn in as Indiana governor in early 2005 and inherited a mess of problems, from a completely dysfunctional state bureaucracy to massive budget deficits as far as the eye could see. Indiana's situation was frighteningly similar to the one facing the junior senator from Illinois upon his own inauguration, just on a smaller scale. Daniels displayed a refreshing willingness to discuss new ideas, some of them deemed as heresy by many conservatives. But as Daniels learned from his time running Eli Lilly, a leader must be open to ideas from every corner. From his time working with Ronald Reagan, Daniels learned that people are more open to new ideas, or even ones outside their own comfort zones, when a leader is willing and able to explain them. Relying on a similar coalition that made Reagan one of the best presidents in American history, Daniels has led the state of Indiana from the brink of the abyss to a state which shines in comparison to the tragic wrecks which are our neighboring states. Yet he didn't accomplish this by reading from one playbook containing a strict ideology, but from seeking opinions and ideas from both sides of the aisle. Frankly, it's yet another lesson that our current president could learn from a proven leader. Governor Daniels has been making headlines in recent months with a host of comments that if one didn't know any better, appear to be designed to alienate the very base that he will need if he does pursue his rumored campaign for the presidency in 2012. First, it was the so-called social issues truce, where my man Mitch was quoted as saying something along the lines of, "The heck with social issues, we gotta fix the economy." As expected, these remarks drew rebukes from all corners, including Indiana Congressman Mike Pence, both a friend of the governor and a man rumored to be interested in succeeding him. But why is it so controversial to simply ponder the inability to work on social issues in a nation facing imminent fiscal collapse? Does anyone really believe that the federal budget will automatically balance itself if we could only ban gay marriage nationwide? This week, Governor Daniels has decided to anger the right even further with comments which, on the surface at least, hint that a potential Daniels presidential administration would pursue plans to enforce a tariff on imported oil as well as the dreaded VAT tax, so popular with the far left. You think someone had told Sarah Palin she couldn't shoot any more moose with the amount of angst being expressed by many on the right? It should be pointed out that Governor Daniels never once stated that he'd pursue those ideas if elected president. He was simply throwing them out for discussion. This certainly wasn't a yes we can moment by any stretch. But what if Daniels was simply expressing a desire to have a mature exchange of ideas regarding the critical problems we face? We can't make fun of Obama supporters for supporting a man whose entire life is one giant hyperbole, while at the same time screaming traitor to anyone willing to embrace ideas which are contrary to the conservative status quo. Besides, if one is open-minded enough, there are merits to the topics that Governor Daniels proposed. It seems rather obvious that instituting a tariff on imported oil would go a long way towards encouraging domestic production, a goal nearly all Tea Party supporters seem to be behind. Instituting some form of value-added tax in combination with a dramatically lowered flat income tax, and perhaps eliminating other forms of taxation such as capital gains, corporate and inheritance taxes, would be an incredible boost to our economy. Again, there are many of the same ideas you can read on signs being carried at Tea Party rallies, just packaged in different ways. Friends, we are at a definite crossroads, both as a nation and as a party. Rejecting any thoughts or ideas which don't rigidly adhere to narrow ideology threatens to banish Republicans to a permanent minority status. Besides, it's not as if proposing the complete abolition of slavery was a safe proposition to take back in the late 1850s, and that bold idea was the very genesis of our party. When you are in a crisis, you can't afford to reject every idea offhand that doesn't appeal to your own personal ideology. The confident, bold, and ultimately successful leader is open to all ideas, accepting or rejecting each based on his own knowledge and experience. Indiana has certainly benefited from this approach, and I think our nation could as well. And I have to admit, Daniels was, when I first read it, I was a little bit surprised, but I wasn't so far taken aback that I thought, you know, to hell with Mitch Daniels, he's totally lost my vote.
Well, when you look at the difference here and you're comparing, you know, look at Barack Obama, who Peter principled out like as a junior senator, and then we have Mitch Daniels, the very successful and popular governor of Indiana. When he says something like that, maybe you need to look past the headlines. You know, look at the substance. Why is he saying this? Where is he getting this from? Because you can't just take everything, you know, and look at it with such little depth.
Absolutely. And this was the conversation that I was having with a friend on Facebook, was that it was all of a sudden, you know, Daniels comes out with this statement and their response is, you know, Daniels is for a value-added tax. No one, you know, even if you give him time to explain it, no real voter is going to look beyond that. They're just going to see a headline. They're going to hear what the media says, and they're going to be like, forget Mitch Daniels.
That's the unfortunate thing about your modern electorate, is though they can't seem to look past the quick soundbite and the headline.
Well, that's why conservatism has such a difficulty with the, I guess, the big majority of people, you know, why liberalism is
the
so...
lowest common denominator.
It is very, yeah, liberalism is just very easy to, and flashy and very surfacey and appeals to your emotions, where conservatism is more of like baseball. But it's a thinking man's position.
Thank you. I love the reference.
Position.
Actually, golf is more of a thinking man's game than baseball.
Okay, Mike, if you didn't control the soundboard, I'd have to kick you off the show for that statement. But the thing is, Mitch Daniels, he's always been a thinking man's candidate. When he first started running for governor in 2003, when he started his campaign, and eventually winning in 2005, during the 2004 race. But I mean, But he had the ability to be a thinking man's candidate and also be very plain spoken. I mean, this is a guy who drove around the state of Indiana in a Winnebago and flannel shirts. And he could appeal to, you know, average Joe Hoosier. And as well as, you know, be able to appeal to the executives in downtown Indianapolis. He could speak their language. And if you look back, Ronald Reagan could do the same thing. He had the ability to take the most complex ideas and bring them down so that your average person could not only understand them, but follow them and say, yes, you know what? That's an idea worth discussing. They may not have always
agreed. So this is kind of like the anti-elitist situation where, you know, the elitists talk above people's heads and we'll take care of it and you just go.
Well, here's the thing. Mitch speaks to his crowd. And Mitch was speaking to the Hudson Institute, a conservative think tank that used to be based in Indiana but is now in Washington, D.C. He was speaking to a think tank. So you'd think that he would actually elevate his level of discourse to be able to communicate with the people who are attending a banquet at a think tank.
Mm-hmm.
So by even just by throwing out the concept of a value-added tax in combination with a flat tax, that has – people need to understand. That's where Governor Daniels was going.
He's outside the box.
He is outside.
And sometimes it's going to take – and I absolutely believe it's going to take outside the box thinking to get us out of this mess.
Well, the thing is the mass media only wants to fit something within 10 column inches.
That's true. Well, you know, hopefully we'll have some more time to discuss this in our final segment. We're going to come right back with Dana Perino, and it's going to be a great conversation, folks. Please stick around. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Gillespie. This is your host, Josh Gillespie. We are here, and I'm thrilled to have Dana Perino on the show. She's if you don't know who Dana Perino is, then your head's been under a rock. She's a former White House press secretary to President George W. Bush and is a regular Fox News contributor. Dana, thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Well, I am thrilled to have you on because we are so close to a Republican takeover of the U.S. House, quite possibly the U.S. Senate. You know, I know it's going to be close. I want to get your thoughts on this. You know, you were in the White House under President Bush when the Republicans lost the majority. Now the White House with the Democrats, they're about to lose their majority. What are they thinking and what are you hearing?
Well, it's very exciting. I mean, 2 years ago, if you had told me that this was possible, I would not have believed you. And I think it's an indication of just yet again America being willing to give a party another chance, right? So for the Democrats, they got another chance in 2006. President Bush was presiding over a very unpopular war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Although the economy was quite good at the time.
That's true.
The war really took over. And people were just sort of, you know, and just to be honest, I think people tire of presidents after about the sixth year. This is true for any presidency, but for President Bush, it was particularly acute for lots of reasons. And anyway, so you get into the 2008 reelection cycle. President Obama wins big. You know, he wins big. But he misunderstands his mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't understand that America is still a center-right country for all intents and purposes, and in fact now possibly even moving back to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And so you ended up with people feeling like the Democrats are out of touch and they really don't like the policies.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, they're very worried about the growth of government. In some ways, government has gotten so big now from over the years that every modern president is going to have this problem where people get very frustrated. How are we actually going to tackle the problems that we have, what are we going to be willing to cut as a country? Well, I think over this past 2 years, people have had a real wake-up call and that they're ready to have that conversation for the first time in a long time, maybe ever.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that's been really surprising and actually somewhat inspiring to me is the number of female candidates that we've been having running, mm-hmm. strong female candidates, especially mm-hmm. on the GOP side. And I know mm-hmm. that in years past, normally we see strong female candidates coming from the Democrats, but it's like a bumper crop, really, of yeah. of great female leaders rising up to the challenge and running for the House and for the Senate. And they're not just, you know, they're taking the bulls by the horn and they're raising some serious coin. I mean, Sharon Angle, yeah. the $14 million in the last quarter, my goodness.
Yeah, they really have come into their own, so to speak. And, you know, I credit both Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, amongst others, mm-hmm. but really just for the most recent examples, with showing women that you can run. And yet it stinks to have your family dragged through the mud. But mm-hmm. there's women that are willing to do it. You know, farther afield, way out on the West Coast, for the first time ever, we have women who are able to self-fund their races.
Mm-hmm.
That's Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina. And they are self-made millionaires, and in Meg's case, a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And they are willing to spend their own money to help them get elected. So that's interesting, too. So, some of the women are not having as easy a time. There's still some old stereotypes that people have to deal with,
mm-hmm.
Including the fact that usually in a down economy, most people, including women, will trust a man to be able to handle that better than a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some things that we still have to deal with, but certainly everything is on the up and up for Republican women all across the country.
Well, do you see...
Even if I could just mention, Josh, I'm sorry, thing that people should focus on is... It's not just white Republican women.
Mm-hmm.
We are about to have two fantastic new governors in our country. Nikki Haley, who is Indian American, will be the governor of South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And Susana Martinez, Hispanic American woman, will be the governor of New Mexico. And, you know, that is that's a step in the right direction for Republicans.
It is. And, you know, the one thing that I was at the Smart Girl Summit in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks
mm-hmm.
ago. And one of the questions that I posed to a couple of the leaders of that, we were discussing Michelle Bachmann, who was a guest at the – actually a speaker at the event. And we were mm-hmm. discussing Marsha Blackburn. And the question that I posed to them, I was like, the strong women that we see – and they're conservative. You know, most of the time when people think of women in politics, they think, you know, they're moderate to liberal. But these are strong conservative women who are running. But do we see when the Republicans take over Congress, you know, when we look at the new Congress in 2011, what role will we see women in leadership? Because they've definitely made their presence known this cycle.
Well, that's true. But remember, there are some really good Republican women that have been in power for a while.
We get Marsha Blackburn.
Sure.
I love Marsha Blackburn.
Kay Granger.
Yes, Kay Granger.
Kay Granger is another one. You mentioned Michelle Bachmann.
Kathy McMorris Rogers.
Sure, and Ileana Ross Layton.
Yes.
And so I believe, just because I've had personal conversations with the current leadership,
mm-hmm.
they know that they need to highlight and showcase more of the Republican women.
Mm-hmm.
They know. They want to as well. And so they are going to have to make an effort. Everybody is going to have to make an effort to have more diverse voices at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not just that. I have a piece coming up on Fox in 2 weeks where I get to highlight some of the diversity amongst the GOP field
mm-hmm.
from Vietnamese Americans, Hispanic Americans, and African Americans who are doing the hard thing of choosing to run for office and they're running as Republicans. It for me, having been in Republican politics for a long time, I'm encouraged by the trend.
Well, I know that the media wants to portray the movement in America, the conservative movement, the Tea Party movement, as, you know, this big white movement. But I
mm-hmm.
think that what we've seen with a number of candidates in a number of states, that really isn't the case. I mean,
it's not fully descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some places, in some areas of the country, that might be true.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fully descriptive, and it's unfortunate. And I think if I could point out that Peter Berkovich of the writes in the Wall Street Journal today of why liberals don't understand the Tea Party movement.
Mm-hmm.
Really good piece. And I think in some ways it's just because initially they thought it was just a fluke, that it would only last a couple of weeks. And now all of a sudden, you know, it is a strong third-party movement. And I will tell you this. One thing that Republicans need to be aware of is that, you know, they're not so popular either.
Mm-hmm.
They might have the people running this time around who have policy positions that people prefer, in some cases, the Republicans, and they really do want to stop the Democrats' liberal agenda that has been marching forward in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, just last week, Mark Penn, a pollster, did a poll about the feelings about the parties, Republicans, Democrats, etc.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting is that he said for the first time he has seen the higher numbers of many Americans supporting a third party. They don't like either party. They want a third party. It might not necessarily be the Tea Party, but they want a third party.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that, you know, when people, when the new class gets to Washington, they're going to have to be mindful of that.
Mm-hmm.
And also people are going to have to be willing to be a little bit patient. You know, no matter what, they're still going to have to deal with a Democrat president.
Mm-hmm.
And that Democrat president, he's not going to allow Obamacare to be repealed.
That's right. Well, Paul Ryan, what said the other day that, you know, for all the talk of trying to put a stranglehold on the funding of Obamacare, the president still has to sign these bills that a Republican Congress passes, mm-hmm. and there's still no guarantee mm-hmm. that he'll do it. And
no, he won't. There is nothing really that President Obama has done that would indicate that he ever would.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to make sure that people are aware that there's going to have to be a little bit of patience. That, you know, movements like this are very exciting at first, and I do think that sometimes they can peter out. But I don't think that's going to happen this time around.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has some staying power.
It's definitely been a strong movement, especially here in Indiana. They've had more effect on local races than, say, congressional or you know, Senate races. But they've definitely been a vocal voice here in Indiana, and they have a lot of elected officials on their toes. But that said, they're still working. What I've noticed with a number of some of these Tea Parties is that they've been willing to work with the county parties at the local level with the county Republicans, yet still serving notice that saying we want to help you guys out now because we believe in, you know, we identify with your beliefs, but if you start straying from us, we have no problem, you know, putting you guys on the hot seat again.
Right. Right. That's true.
And it's definitely been an interesting movement.
Can we mention, go back to women for a minute?
No, because absolutely.
It's not just the women who are running for office. It's women are increasingly involved in politics. Like, you know, we could always find women that were volunteering on campaigns. That's not new.
Mm-hmm.
But women attending the rally, bringing somebody, bringing their families, their especially young grandmothers. Peggy Noonan wrote a great piece about 2 weeks ago about how many women are involved in the Tea Party movement.
Yeah, they're leaders.
And Martha Blackburn said that she was surprised when she goes there, and she's a grandmother of very young grandbabies as well, and she said how many other women were there with young grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a trend that demographers, I'm sure, are taking a look at. But why is that? Because they're worried that those children won't have, you know, the wonderful opportunities that they had. And they're worried, really worried about the debt.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you real quick. Do you notice with these women running, do they run differently than men? Do they run with a different purpose in their campaigns? With a different drive than men typically run a campaign?
I don't think so this time around, because really the main issue in the campaign has been jobs and the economy,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they focused on, and government spending and growth of government.
Yes.
Typically, however, women do not like negative advertisements. It turns them off,
mm-hmm.
And they might start to tune out when they hear that. And so, you know, it might get women out of their comfort zone when they have to define their opponent in a 30-second ad. They might not want to do that, but, you know, you have to be willing to paint them the way they're painting you.
Absolutely. And they've been doing a fantastic job, and they're going to be well represented in the next Congress. I am thrilled with the candidates that have come forward, especially the female candidates. They're incredibly impressive, and they're well representative of the party and of conservative values. And I'm excited. I'm very much excited for the next Congress.
Well, they're lucky to have your support.
No, they will. Absolutely. Absolutely. Dana, thank you for being a part of our show. I know you got to run, but it's been fantastic to have you on and get your perspective.
You're welcome, and congratulations on having a show. It takes a lot of work, and I appreciate it.
And you're welcome. And Pete Seat told me to say this, but he says hi. He wanted me to do it on air. So.
Okay, the one thing you have to ask Pete Seat is, what is Dana? And the answer is, she's always right.
I'll make sure to pass that message along.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dana.
Okay.
I really appreciate
it. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. and we'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Gillespie. I'm your host, Josh Gillespie. We are speaking with Mark Tapson, and Christy has brought our attention to Mark. Christy, tell us a little bit about Mark.
Well, Mark is a writer-screenwriter, and he writes about the intersection of Hollywood and terrorism for Andrew Breitbart's websites, Big Hollywood and Big Peace, as well as David Horowitz's Front Page and Newsreel blog. And why he's here with us today is because he was the writer's assistant on the controversial miniseries The Path to 9/11. Welcome. I'm so glad you could join us, Mark.
Glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Now, apparently, we've had some controversies with The Path to 9/11. And Disney paid to have this produced and spent quite a lot of money. And it seems like after it's all finished, they no longer want it to be aired. Can you give us a little bit of background on that situation?
Oh, yeah. It was actually a very controversial miniseries that aired on September 11th and 12th back in 2006. Very controversial. I'll get to the whole controversy in just a moment. But essentially what happened was it aired once, has never aired again, and is not being released on DVD. And the reason for that is that Disney doesn't want this miniseries to impact the political future of Hillary Clinton. And here's what it's all about. The Path 9/11 was a miniseries that basically traced the historical thread that ran from the 1993 World Trade Center bombing all the way up to the attacks on the morning of September 11th. So it's going to dramatize that. It's not a documentary. It's a docudrama. So it's going to dramatize that, and as Disney produced this miniseries, which cost them upwards of $30 million, it was the most expensive miniseries ever made, they were so proud of this project initially that it was their intention to air it not only on every 9/11 anniversary, but also to put it into schools. They were going to use it in schools as a kind of an engaging educational tool about the history behind the attacks. Well, just before that miniseries aired, this explosion of a controversy erupted. It was literally front page news. The Clinton administration alumni got wind of this miniseries and were concerned about how Clinton would be portrayed in terms of combating terrorism during the 90s. And they began to think that this would affect their political legacy. So they pulled out all the stops to suppress this miniseries before it even aired. Very nearly succeeded. I mean, we didn't know up until the last 24 hours whether or not it was going to air at all. So it was quite unusual for a miniseries or a TV show to attract that much political pressure.
So now, what would be the reaction of those who were involved in this, who put all the work in this and who are completely behind it? Was it... I would think it would be quite devastating.
Yeah, it's very frustrating for a couple of reasons. One is that during the controversy itself, the filmmakers, primarily my good friend Cyrus Narasta, who wrote the screenplay and who later went on to write and direct the more recent Stoning of Soraya M. I don't know if you know about that, but mm-hmm. Cyrus and the director, David Cunningham, were both the targets of an internet smear campaign, which was very alarming. And in fact, I know that my friend Cyrus actually received death threats from the left over this. So it was very disturbing in that respect. And then since then, to have this project just be buried is also pretty disturbing, because it's such a blatant incident of the suppression of free speech.
You
know, I mean, there are, you know, you can go down the street to Blockbuster, or from Netflix you can order Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, or you can get the documentary Loose Change about the truther perspective on the whole 9/11 attacks. You can get those easily, and you should be able to, but you can't get The Path to 9/11 on DVD. It's outrageous.
And, you know, I would think that the Path to 9/11 would go a long way in combating a lot of the truther issues that we have. Although I have to wonder if the combating the truther issues is not something that would work in favor of the Democrats.
I have to say, Mark, this whole thing kind of floors me. I mean, because, you know, we see that the media is giving fuel to in a sense, not the grand scheme of the media, but at least with people like Michael Moore and all the release of these DVDs about the whole truther thing. I mean, these terrorist attacks, I mean, they span multiple presidencies. And I would say that the more information that, you know, people have, the more that we understand this, the more that we realize that, you know, one, our government isn't behind this. It's ludicrous to think that they even could be. And it's an insult to the fighting men and women who are in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I agree.
Who are fighting terrorism to say that our government is even behind this. What pressure is being mounted to help combat this? What can people who are listening to this do to help in getting this DVD series out?
That's a good question, because, and I get that all the time whenever I speak about this or whenever anyone else associated with the movie speaks about it. People always get frustrated and outraged by this, and they say, what can we do to correct this? And probably the main thing that you can do, the easiest thing you can do at this point, is to go to a Facebook page. If you're on Facebook, and if you're not, I'll give you another alternative. But if you're on Facebook, look up a page called Rebroadcast, The Path to 9/11, on the 10th anniversary, and release the DVD. If you just look up, I think, Rebroadcast, The Path to 9/11, you'll find it on Facebook. You can join that group, and it gives you an option to sign a petition to be sent to Disney to try to mount some public pressure on them to release the DVD.
Now, I'll be posting this petition on ChristyKelly.com as well as the Facebook page. So people will be able to access it at ChristyKelly.com.
Yeah, I think the web address is ipetitions.com/petition/thepath to 9/11.
Mm-hmm. How many people
probably easier for them to just look it up on your website. But,
sure. Mark, how many people have signed the petition so far?
You know, I'm not sure about that because the person who's handling it, Risa Kirkland, basically has all that information. I believe you guys are going to be talking to her in the near future.
That's all right.
So she'd be better to ask. I'm afraid I don't have those figures.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine.
We're aiming for a million. Let's put it that way.
Gotcha. Is there a time, kind of a time frame that you want to get all this wrapped up? I mean, clearly you want to have this for the 10th anniversary. Is that the goal, to have that by September 11th of next year?
Well, I think the sooner the better. You know, because you have to get the wheels. excuse me, you have to get the wheels turning at the studios to make things happen and have time for that. So, the sooner the better. And also, you know, in terms of getting the DVD released, that would take some time also to have those produced and that kind of thing. So. You know, I don't want to give people the impression that we can put this off until, say, September 10th of next year.
Yeah, sure. No, exactly.
The sooner the better, because it takes a while to get the
right. I think people are completely oblivious to what has happened in this situation. You know, it's just not there, and nobody has really thought about it and realized that, in fact, you know, Disney has shut this down. And when more people hear about the issue, they'll be much more inclined to do something about it. And we are right there with you. We want to get out the information, have it exposed. And there is another documentary that was produced blocking the path to 9/11 that I understand you were interviewed for, that is also working towards exposing these issues.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You took the words right out of my mouth. That documentary is awesome. It is so well done. It was put together by my friend, the radio host, John Ziegler, who did a fantastic job with it. And I guarantee you, if you watch this documentary, you will be blown away. Everyone I know who has seen it is just astounded and outraged, because he really lays out the whole controversy very well. Like you said, Blocking the Path to 9/11 is the title. I think you can get it from the website blockingthepath.com, but it's also available through Amazon and Netflix and all that, so it's readily available. But just to make a distinction really clear here, that is a documentary about the making of the miniseries, The Path 9/11. The Path 9/11 is actually not a documentary, which I think a lot of people are confused about. It's a dramatization. It's a, you know, an historical drama. So it has actors in the script and all that. So just to make that distinction clear.
Well, Mark, this is just kind of a stunning thing to think that, you know, free speech in this case is basically being suppressed.
Yeah.
You know, we want to continue to help you in your fight. Again, we want you guys to check out the Blocking the Path to 9/11 site on Facebook. We'll have the petition up at ChristyKelly.com and Hoosier Access. I don't want to be leaving out the site, our site as well. We want to get this up as much as possible. And Mark, I really thank you for coming on today's show. We'll be having John Ziegler and Risa on in subsequent episodes, just to kind of to continue to put the pressure on out there, and so that people are more aware of what's going on.
Great, we appreciate that. It's really important. I mean, besides just the suppression of free speech at work here, it's a great miniseries. I mean, it's a fantastic piece of work, and it's a powerful piece. I mean, the whole attack on the morning of 9/11, that's something we cannot allow ourselves to forget or to be buried in the past, and I think the current administration would like us to do that. So it's important.
Yep.
I appreciate your help.
Well, thank you, Mark, and we'll continue to support your efforts. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, guys.
And welcome back to Gillespie. We have had a great show so far. We've talked to Dana Perino. We've talked to Mark Tapson of Big Government. But, of course, we always like to close out our show with our standard bearer, our newly renamed, redesigned standard bearer, though, WTF Tuesdays. And just making you say, what the? All right. And this week's, we got a duel. We want to start off here real quick with... We're gonna keep the kicker for the second part of this. So we're gonna start off a little easy. Nick Rahal, who is an incumbent Democrat congressman from the 3rd District of, I believe, New York, or maybe it's West Virginia. I don't care where he's from. Anyway, Congressman Nick Rahal. He was asked about climate change. Now, he's a Democrat, so you can maybe guess where he's coming from. But here's the full quote, and it just after you hear it, you're gonna be like, what the? Climate change, you know, science is an idiotic practice. You can take scientists' facts and figures, and I'm not a scientist, and use them any way you want. The fact of the matter is, wait a minute, he's just about to use facts the way he wants. The fact of the matter is, the whole world today and the country is looking that there is a climate change and it needs to be addressed. Otherwise, there would be responsible coal operators from West Virginia be in my office on a regular blah, 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 blah. He talks about coal miners from West Virginia coming to his office. He goes on to say, climate change, to deny it exists, to just put your head in the sand and, oh no, it doesn't exist, what are you talking about, is about like standing on the floor of Macy's during the month of December and claiming Santa Claus doesn't exist. Come on, get real. Okay.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
news to Congressman Nick Rahal. Santa Claus doesn't exist. Those guys in the suits, they're not real.
And that one that just comes up to you and says, ho, 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 is a robot.
You know, it amuses me. One, he tries to say that, you know, people can make facts say what they want, but the fact of the matter is, he makes some crazy statement trying to say that these are the facts. So he's trying to twist his own facts, and then he goes on and says that, you know, to make his claim that climate change is real is to say that Santa Claus exists. Santa Claus, what the heck? That has to be one of the
Never let the fact get in the way of a good story.
I know. Seriously, that has to be one of the dumbest statements I think I've come across. Yeah, let's prove climate change exists by claiming that Santa Claus exists. What numbskull thought that was a good idea to let
Well, obviously, say? He's a Democrat.
Well, obviously, he's a Democrat, but doesn't he have someone to say, you know what, Congressman, you may not want to say that exactly.
Oh, but he'll earn all kinds of brownie points with the Greenpeace folks, the MoveMoron.org folks, and you know, and those fringe kook groups.
All I know is that according to Democratic Congressman Nick Driscoll, was that his name again? Yeah, Nick Rahal. The climate change is to the truth as Santa Claus is to the truth. All right. WTF, Nick Rahal. WTF. Second one. And Mike, you brought this to my attention. And, of course, it's been in the news all week. It was
White House senior advisor David Axelrod.
Yes.
For the continuing campaign of the White House against the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In fact, as we were taping this show, it was just the topic of discussion on Fox News Channel. The Democratic National Committee has aired television and radio ads claiming that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is accepting.
Hold on. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce with the evil Karl Rove and Ed Gillespie.
Ed Gillespie, who is not a relative of yours.
But I call him Cousin Ed anyway, because dang it, I wish he was. I have Cousin Ed's book. Anyway,
who said... accused the evil triumvirate of accepting foreign money to buy the corporations and ruin democracy. And they, in the television ad, which I did not see until today, was of a shadowy figure snatching a purse away from a woman.
Yeah.
Mike Wallace, father of Chris Wallace on Fox News Channel, also the same Mike Wallace of longtime 60 Minutes fame, who isn't exactly very conservative, works for CBS News, asked David Axelrod, do you really have any proof that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and these groups accepted foreign money? And the only answer that David Axelrod had was, well, do you have any proof they didn't?
I have to say, and I know you typically don't like me doing this, but because it came to my mind right now, I'm going to play this off my laptop. This whole situation reminds me of this scene from the movie So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Okay, it's
from the 1992 Mike Myers, and he's talking about conspiracy, shall we say.
Facts, Sonny Jim, that there's a secret society of the five wealthiest people in the world known as the Pentaveret, who run everything in the world, including the newspapers, and meet tri-annually at a secret country mansion in Colorado known as the Meadows.
So who's in this Pentaveret?
The Queen, the Vatican, the Gettys, the Rothschilds, and Colonel Sanders before he went tits up. I hated the Colonel with his wee beady eyes and that smug look on his face. Oh, you're gonna buy my chicken. Oh,
Dad, how can you hate the Colonel?
Because he puts an addictive chemical in his chicken that makes you crave it fortnightly, smart ass.
Interesting. Cuckoo.
That's my response to David Axelrod.
Cuckoo.
Cuckoo. I mean, seriously, the Democrats and David Axelrod,
there's another term that I could almost use to describe the Democrat brain trust right now. And I really can't use the word here on FTR your show because you don't want me to use BS crazy.
They are. And they're about as BS crazy as the dad from So I Married an Axe Murderer. Because they're making all sorts of crazy connections. And, I mean, just like you said, Mike Wallace asks David Axelrod to prove it exists. And all he can say is, tell me it doesn't. Prove to me it doesn't. Santa Claus exists!
Prove to me that it doesn't.
Prove to me that it doesn't.
Well, I like to see you go home tonight and tell Jack and Hannah and Sarah that, Santa Claus don't exist.
They don't, we don't bring up Santa Claus very much. We don't feel like lying to the kids. So
that's a novel
I know,
way to.
We still we still do the stockings, but you know,
Santa Claus does. You don't use that as an excuse to get the kids to bed early on Christmas Eve, so you and Mrs. Gillespie can have some alone time on the couch.
No, no, we don't do that. Anyway, so it struck me as funny. I mean, it totally. You listen to these guys. You listen to David Axelrod. You listen to Congressman Nick Rahal, and your jaw just drops, and you have to say, "What the F is going on with these people?" Seriously, the connections that they are making are so broad, and they're loose. There's not even anything that can bring them closely
together.
You know,
and speaking of that statement up by David Axelrod, you can almost apply that to that congressman. Well, prove to me that global warming doesn't exist.
No, exactly. That's what I want to say. You know, sure, David Axelrod wants Mike Wallace to prove that there's no connection. Okay, fine then. Allow me to also prove to you that Santa Claus doesn't exist. Or that he does. Apparently, that's what I need to do, is I need to prove to you that Santa Claus exists. It's mind-boggling, I gotta tell you. Anyway, we've come to the end of what I feel has been a spectacular show. I'm still really excited about this show. I hope you guys have been too. I want you to stick around. We got Aaron Proctor next, followed by Duke Over America, Jenny Erickson at 10 o'clock, and then Michael Fidanza, the armchair energist, at 11 o'clock. Guys, I hope you come back next week. We're going to continue having great shows. I can't say
two
yet.
2 weeks until Election Day.
2 weeks until Election Day, and hopefully I can't say yet for sure whether we'll have a special guest, but I'm working on another one, another doozy. Stay tuned. We'll be on to Gillespie again next week. FTRradio.com. See ya.